This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
Jim and I actually met at a conference on healthcare delivery to the poor, and that conference was put on by the Christian Community Health Fellowship, CCHF. I don't know if any of you are familiar with them. They actually have a nice publication, and they have a student section on there to encourage students who are interested in serving the poor. And that fellowship is really a network of people who are engaged in serving the poor in the United States. It's not overseas. And those people are involved in rural areas as well as in urban areas. And so Jim and I met through that conference because both of us had felt as students, and even prior to that, I actually became a Christian as a high school student in Egypt. And so you become a Christian in a land where you're a minority, and you see a lot of people who are very lost. And I had a grandfather who was a physician and worked in a coal mining town in West Virginia, and that was really my role model of his service there. So I was pretty convinced that I wanted to be a career medical missionary overseas and was kind of looking that direction, and was surprised to find someone else who was really excited and interested to do the same sort of thing. And again, we both felt called, and we actually got married when I was a fourth-year medical student and Jim was starting his internship. And our first 2 years of marriage were really grueling. They were back-to-back internships. And interns and residents at that time were working about 120 to 150 hours a week. They actually made us keep track of our hours. And the way it worked was interns would have one Saturday off per month, and residents would have one Sunday off per month, and then you would get 1 week vacation. So if you can imagine, during our first 2 years of marriage, we didn't ever go to church together except for that 1 week of vacation, though actually our first year of marriage, it was spent, instead of the University of Chicago, it was spent at Northwestern, where my dad was having surgery for kidney sarcoma. So we did have a little bit of a change of environment from one hospital to another. So we really didn't have a whole lot of opportunity to fellowship with other Christians during that year or with one another. It was very, very difficult. And we were getting close to our first wedding anniversary, and, you know, I was thinking about the year and how it had been, and it wasn't exactly the anniversary, but I said to Jim, you know, kind of thinking about things, you know, how has this last year been for you? And of course, you know, he's immersed in the struggle and the stress of the internship, and he said to me, it's been the worst year of my life. And you have to understand that Jim came from a family where he was abused and his dad was an alcoholic, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, our marriage, the worst year of his life. And I was crushed. But really, it came to the next year when I was going through my internship, when I really appreciated what he'd said, because it really had to have been the worst year of my life as well. And, you know, medicine can be incredibly demanding. I think it's that way for nurses as well as physicians. Dentists, I don't know who else we have in the audience. And maybe there's some others, allied health, social workers and whatnot. But it is, because you're involved in people's lives and life and death kind of situations and in people's suffering. And so it is stressful. There's no doubt. So following these first two stressful years of our marriage, we had a very difficult pregnancy and the birth of our first child, who was born prematurely and who developed hypoglycemia on her fourth day of life and seizures and encephalopathy. And then we all spent the first month of her life in the neonatal intensive care unit together. And so, you know, that was sort of the start of things. And I think we still hoped for a long time that we would get overseas as medical missionaries. We went down to Emory. Jim was at the Centers for Disease Control, and I did my master's in public health, in international health education, and we were preparing to head off to Cameroon with the Presbyterian Church. We pretty much paid off our loans, and that can be a really challenging kind of thing. But then Miriam, our daughter, began to have intractable seizures, and our plans just came to a screeching halt. We realized, you know, we had a year really of things being pretty uncontrolled. There was no way we were going anywhere, and we decided to return to Chicago. For a variety of reasons. We had social support here, we had family, and we knew the medical system very well. Both of us had actually volunteered as students at Lawndale Christian Health Center, which is where I work now as an internist and a pediatrician. And we had both volunteered there as students, and I think Jim kind of moonlighted and helped them out on Tuesday nights. And we decided that was the best thing to do. He was an infectious disease specialist. They were looking for someone to start their AIDS clinic. The city had contracted with them to start up a TB clinic. And so we headed back here. And it really wasn't what I wanted to do. It really wasn't what I thought God had planned for me. From the time that I had become a Christian, I knew what it was that I was to do. I had heard a call. And so I came to Lawndale, to be honest, I was very angry. But you know, how are you angry with your child? And the reality is you're really angry with God, because he's changed your plans. And so I had to really learn what it is to learn to bloom where you are planted. And that's a reality for many of us, that we will end up in places that we didn't intend to be or didn't want to be, and really cannot believe that this is the reality for us, that this is the God's plan for us. And one thing about flourishing is to learn how to bloom where you're planted. I don't know, is there anybody else here who's a gardener? But boy, the soil makes a difference. You know, the light, the water, and it's critical. So let me tell you a little bit about Lawndale Christian Health Center. We actually, right now, are here on the west side, and I guess some folks had a chance to visit one of our clinics. There are three clinics now, and actually there's an outreach to Afghanistan at this point as well. The patient population is about 55% African American, about 45% Hispanic, and about 45% of our patients have no insurance. Part of the vision of Lawndale Community Church, who started the clinic, was really based on the three R's or principles of John Perkins. And I don't know if you've read any of John Perkins' work, but this has to do with the ideas of relocation, relocating into the community. It has to do with rehabilitation of the community and reconciliation, racial reconciliation. And again, many of the initial people who started the clinic moved into the neighborhood and lived there, rehabbed buildings, began working as a church community there. And this was the goal of the clinic. And over time, over the many years that it's been there, it has just progressed to the place at which we are serving now over 120,000 patients now. One of the biggest things that I learned initially working at Lawndale was about my own prejudices and about my own racism. And I think that change and growth can be very humbling. And I discovered, you know, my own inadequacies. I thought that I was very prepared and that I would do wonderfully. And I realized that it was a cross-cultural experience. I had a lot to learn about other cultures that I was working with. And that was very humbling. And I think that it's important to realize that working in that kind of cross-cultural, cross-racial setting is also incredibly rewarding, as much as it can be very, very challenging and very hard. And I thought I would share with you a little parable that was adapted from Luke 18:9-14. I entitled it, The Doctor and the Prostitute. See if I can find it here. This parable is told to some who are complacently pleased with themselves over their moral performance and look down their noses at others. Two people went up to the clinic one day, one a doctor and the other a prostitute. The doctor walked through the waiting room, passing a garishly dressed woman. Ugh, the doctor thought. I thank God I am not like so many of these people, immoral, adulterous, or heaven forbid like that prostitute. I go to church and Bible study every week. I'm pretty regular about daily devotions and prayer time, and I tithe all that I receive, not to mention I am dedicating my life to serve the poor. Meanwhile, the prostitute slumped into the shadows, her face in her hands, not daring to look up, and cried out in her heart, God, give mercy, forgive me, a sinner. I tell you the truth. Of the two sinners who went up to the clinic that day, only one went out to her house made right with God. For everyone who exalts himself or herself will be humbled. He who humbles himself will be exalted. So I don't know, you can probably change doctor to nurse practitioner or physician assistant or pharmacist or medical student or psychologist or professor. And feel free to substitute prostitute as well for any kind of personally challenging patient that you might see. Actually, one of the most challenging ones I find right now is the pimp. but it could be the IV drug abuser or the pregnant teenager or the mentally ill or developmentally disabled. or someone post-abortion. But I would encourage you to think about adapting some of those parables to your own life. And certainly that's something that's been life-changing and transforming for me, to work among the poor, something I really didn't expect. I didn't realize that I even had some of those prejudices. To be a Christian in healthcare is not merely to promote and restore health and prevent disease, but it is to be like Christ. It's not merely to prescribe drugs, but to give hope and vision. I am called to help restore people to abundant life and to wholeness and to health in body, mind, and spirit. At times, as a physician, I am called to move beyond my role as a clinician and to see the broader role as a public health physician, even into the realm of social justice. If I see a little girl in the emergency room for a rat bite, and I clean it, and I bandage it, and I put antibacterial ointment on it, and I give her a tetanus shot and antibiotics by mouth, I send her right back to the same rat-infested housing project, I've done very little for her long-term health. In a matter of days or weeks, she'll be back with another rat bite. The first year of our marriage, I spent 9 weeks on a MAB Reader's Digest scholarship to what was then Zaire. And actually, those scholarships are still available. I went as a fourth-year medical student. It paid my way to get there. I worked with an amazing, godly man, Dr. Dan Fountain, who was trained as a surgeon. But actually, after years of treating parasites and diarrheal diseases and seeing the same patients day after day, he went back, actually, to Johns Hopkins and did a master's in public health. And he began to put into practice those things, teaching and training regarding clean water and latrines and immunizations. And the amazing thing was to watch him in action, integrating scriptural teaching with the Zairians. I actually learned there is a passage in Deuteronomy, maybe some of you are familiar with this, that tells people that they must dig a hole and cover their excrement. And so when people learned that this was actually biblical, it was much more convincing to use a latrine, which no one had ever used before. These were Christian communities that he was working with. "I killed my own child," she said. "Don't you understand? I knew what I was doing. I was a Christian when I had my abortion. I don't believe God can forgive this." We see a lot of teenage pregnancies, a lot of domestic violence, a lot of sexually transmitted diseases. And in the beginning, I hated asking about previous pregnancies. When I heard I'd had an abortion, or two, or even six, I felt horror and disgust. I chose not to pursue any further questions. I held myself apart. I moved on to other things. But thankfully, God's Spirit does not allow us to stay in places of hardness or judgment. After reading The Atonement Child by Francine Rivers, and over time, God transformed my attitude so that I might become an instrument of healing in His hands. Not every woman, not every visit, but as directed by the Spirit, I'm prepared to give an answer for the hope that is in me, and I speak of Jesus and His atonement. I can offer her forgiveness and new life in Him. I can give her hope. I am more prepared if I pray before I get to work, and if I pray throughout the day, and if I dedicate the day to the Lord. You see, I have become to believe in divine appointments. Why is this woman in my room? For the love of God to be manifest, for the light to be brought into a place of darkness, for restoration, that I might share the forgiveness of Christ. You see, David was a man after God's own heart. David the king who knew better. David who knew exactly what he was doing, committed murder also. I state the facts. In Psalm 32, David says, "When I kept silent, my bones wasted away. And then I acknowledged my sin to you, and I did not cover up my iniquity, and you forgave the guilt of my sin." In Psalm 51, written after the murder, it says, "A broken and contrite heart, O God, you will not despise." Jan was emaciated. I knew she was ill the moment that I saw her. My mind began to work through the differential: tuberculosis, AIDS, cancer, drugs. She admitted to drinking with a group of friends most of the day and having no appetite. She had lost 30 pounds. She failed to follow up until several months later. We were unable to contact her, since the address and phone number she had given initially were incorrect. The hoarseness that she told me was just a cold on her first initial visit had worsened. Now she barely weighed 100 pounds. "I think you have cancer of the throat," I told her. I made an appointment with the ear, nose, and throat. When she returned for preoperative labs, I said, "Do you have a church home or a place of spiritual worship?" "Oh, I am so very far away," she said. "I haven't been to church in years. I think it is too late for me." It is never too late. God is very near to you, and He has been waiting for you. I reminded her of the story of the prodigal son. that the father was waiting and watching for the son when he was still very far away. The father saw him and ran to him. I showed her the pen I had been writing the chart with. I'm giving you this pen as a free gift. You understand, as a free gift. You don't have to do anything to deserve it. The pen lay in my hand. She didn't reach for it. But you see, I said, it's not really yours until you take it. God is offering you the gift of life and love, and it is your choice. He never forces anyone to do his will, and you are his beloved child. He longs to be close to you again. What an incredible privilege it is to pray with my patients and to share the gospel so freely. The Westminster Catechism says that the chief aim of man is to glorify God. To glorify God means reflecting his nature, bearing his image, mirroring his love and mercy, his power, righteousness, and justice. When Jesus began his ministry, he read the words from Isaiah 61 in the temple. The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recovery of sight to the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. We do these things when we bear his image. People often wonder about the drug addicts. They're a little nervous. Even some of our doctors prefer not to deal with the drug addicts. But actually, I have probably been more ministered to by many of my patients who struggle with addiction than any other group. Many weeks I see between 2 and 6 new patients going into drug rehabilitation through the Teen Challenge program. It's a Christian approach to addictions of all sorts. Many of them have never even heard the story of the prodigal son, but they know what it means to be eating out of the garbage can, and they can identify with the concept of coming to your senses. I ask them what God has been teaching them, and their testimonies are moving and inspiring. Addiction is a form of idolatry. Most of us are addicted to something, usually less damaging physically than drugs and alcohol. I try to remove some of the shame by talking about the universality of addiction and sin and temptation. We all sin, whether it is anger, alcohol, gambling, gluttony, pride, internet pornography, cocaine. I talk about how we all have a need for affection and meaning, and how easily we fall into temptation when we are alone. We are called to be fishers of men. Jim says it's not our job to clean up the fishbowl. It's our job to fish. So I ask a lot of questions, fishing around. When my grandmother died in 1999, I became clinically depressed for about a year. She had had a stroke, and her children, my mother and her siblings, decided to withhold all treatment, including fluids. She died about a week later. I'm opposed to euthanasia, and I felt very helpless to change the course of those events. She was a wonderful Quaker woman who felt very close to God in her garden. She reminded me throughout college and medical school to take time to smell the flowers, and I would remind you all of that too. I would call it now the gift of depression, because it allowed me to understand in a way that nothing else could have what my patients were going through. It wasn't just textbook knowledge, it was life experience, and it was a gift. Perhaps some of you have received gifts, and maybe you've thought of them more as Paul did in 2 Corinthians, a thorn. A thorn can be a physical illness, a sickness, a bodily limitation. It could be chronic pain. It can be emotional, like anxiety or depression, a history of abuse. But it can draw you closer to the Savior, and it can help you to be sensitive to others in crisis. And it can serve to reduce pride and sloth, and it will certainly keep your eyes on Him. Insecurity makes us seek God and brings about true humility and empathy. A thorn or a gift can enable the power of Christ to be alive and active in our lives.
Listening to Amy reminded me of parts that I sort of don't think about or wasn't going to touch on, but it's sort of interesting how God works. We were interviewing back when we were leaving the CDC. I was in something called the Epidemic Intelligence Service, which is a 2-year public health training program. I'd always had this dream to go overseas and do public health. And so we were down in Atlanta, and we were interviewing around. Once we decided that Miriam was too sick for us to go overseas, we were looking for underserved populations around the U.S., and we literally visited all these Indian Health Service sites. And we kept hearing about Pine Ridge, South Dakota, and everybody at the other site said, oh, nobody goes there, it's really tough, you have to have a real missionary zeal. And so the more negatives we heard, the more excited we got about Pine Ridge, South Dakota. And so we showed up there in a blizzard with Ruth in tow, right? Our second child was just a little infant.
and Miriam was staying with the grandparents in Chicago. And so anyway, we showed up in this blizzard, and we were really impressed. It was definitely a fixer-upper. You were out in the middle of nowhere on the reservation. They were way understaffed. They had like 10 physicians, but only 2 physicians. You'd live right near the hospital. But it had all the things we liked, cross-cultural, underserved population. And so we decided that night, we had already interviewed at Lawndale in Chicago, Lawndale Christian Health Center, and Art Jones and Linda later told us that they knew after we met that we weren't going to come there. And we weren't. We had decided to go to Pine Ridge, and literally the night we were going to call them to say we're going to go to Pine Ridge, Miriam had another intractable seizure. We ended up in the intensive care unit. And the problem with Pine Ridge is we were 2 to 3 hour drive from a major city with a pediatric neurologist. And so we looked at each other and said, can we really intubate our own child? Could we really do this ourselves? And so then we called Art up and said, okay, we'll come in the Lawndale. So it is interesting how God moves us through. I think what is really even more fascinating to me about that story is that's the last intractable seizure she ever had was that night. And then from then on, she's gotten better. And so it was kind of interesting that we've gone through a tumultuous year of her health. It's not been easy since, and she remains with quite a bit of disability in other ways, but no seizures. So it's interesting how God works. I'm going to shift gears. We mentioned both Amy and I trained in med peds at University of Chicago. I did infectious diseases also because I was a year ahead of Amy. I did a clinical year. Then we went to the CDC. And so we both have trained in essentially primary care and public health, and I have additional infectious disease training. And I do love being around students and residents. So when we came back to Chicago, I worked at Lawndale, but I knocked on the door at Rush Medical School and said, hey, I'm trained in ID, I'm med peds, could I be part-time faculty? We also had an issue that we didn't really have adequate health insurance. So I literally said to the chairman, I said, I'll work just for health insurance. You know, you don't have to pay me, just you know, whatever you need. And so I joked about being on the side of the expressway with a little card that said, we'll work for health insurance. But so what I've done since 1993 is I've been on faculty at Rush in both medicine and pediatrics, and I'm boarded in both adult and pediatric ID, but I've been predominantly stationed in pediatrics. And I'm actually the director of pediatric infectious diseases as well as the residency program director for their MedPeds program. So I've hung out in the academic world. I didn't go there directly, though. I worked at Lawndale for almost 5 years, developed an AIDS program, a TB program, enjoyed it, was really primarily a clinician and a little bit of administration and grant writing. But I sort of yearned for, I guess, more public health. I felt like I was seeing patients constantly. I think Amy gains great love and joy from those constant interactions with patients. And frankly, I felt more drained. And so I was recruited to direct the TB control program for the whole city, which I did for a little while, a couple years. And then I was recruited to be in charge of the healthcare system for the Cook County Jail and juvenile detention. And during that time, I developed a pretty extensive program with lots of grants from CDC and NIH to do some innovative things like screen women for cervical cancer, implement a hepatitis program with vaccination, really always focusing on the public health end of it. And then finally, about 4 years ago, Rush recruited me to be a full-time faculty, and that's where I'm at now. So I've had sort of a journey across many different things that some of you might be considering. I've been a predominant clinician in the inner city, which is great, but really wasn't fulfilling all my sort of joys and heart's desires. I've been a predominantly administrator, which again, there was some great joy to see the impact on these detainees' health, but I was really yearning for a little bit more teaching and interaction with residents and students, which I have now. So with all of that, I'm going to give you kind of my reflections on flourishing in medicine. Long verse, but I do want to read some of it. This is the verse, actually, that Amy and I had read at our wedding, which caused a lot of pause because it's not a typical wedding ceremony verse. I'm going to start with halfway down, then your light will break. So at the beginning in Isaiah, the prophet is saying, what is it that God really requires of us? And what he says is that he requires us to clothe the naked and to take care of those who are need shelter. And he says, the prophet says, then your light will break forth like the dawn and your healing will quickly appear. Then your righteousness will go before you and the glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. Then you will call and the Lord will answer and you will cry for help and he will say, here am I. If you do away with the yoke of oppression, with the pointing finger and the malicious talk, and if you spend yourselves in behalf of the hungry and satisfy the needs of the oppressed, then your light will rise in the darkness and your night will become like the noonday. The Lord will guide you always. He will satisfy your needs in a sun-scorched land and will strengthen your frame. You will be like a well-watered garden, like a spring whose waters never fail. It sounds sort of like you're flourishing. And so this is, you know, we read this at our wedding, and it's been a bit of a verse for us for 20 years. And it really, I think, is at the heart of what I see my medicine ministry to be, which is to look after the needs of the hungry and the poor. And it really has been a source of replenishment. I take students and residents to Africa as often as I can. Hopefully it'll be a multiple times a year. And Amy also goes overseas with Medical Benevolence Foundation. People always say to me, don't you get drained when you go there and there's kids dying on rounds and, you know, there's all this suffering? And boy, I just come back energized. I just love to be able to minister to people in need. So it's been a real delight. I want to make a couple of quick points about Christian mission, because that's really been a focus. One of my passions right now is the residency program director of the MedPeds residency at Rush. We're trying to cultivate a residency that's hallmark is underserved populations. So our vision is to have a system in which our residents go for a month to preferably sub-Saharan Africa, but somewhere overseas, go for a month in inner city rotation, go for a month to rural rotation, spend time with the health department doing public health. Basically, a primary care program that really focuses on underserved populations. So what does that have to do with missions? Well, missions, of course, started with Paul and the early missionary journeys. There was kind of a dark time in the Middle Ages when Christianity retreated, largely due to expansion of the Muslim Empire. I'm going to go quickly to the next stage, which is this is the one that all your atheist friends or your agnostic friends like to pillar Christians about, and that's sort of the self-interest period of Christian mission, which is, I love this quote by a Spanish soldier and historian. Why did he go overseas to share the gospel? To serve God and his majesty, to give light to those who are in darkness, and to grow rich as well as all what men desire. So there's clearly mixed motives. This is what we're always given grief about as Christians. But there's also what I think is really neat, which is really the era that we are recipients of. And that is, prior to 1790s, only the Catholic Church had large-scale missionary efforts. But then in the late 1700s, the Protestants joined in. And the three legs of Protestant Christian missions have always been health, education, and evangelism. And those are really the big three things that the Presbyterians do in sub-Saharan Africa, and they're a big part of what we do when we go over there and work. And in the 1950s, there were 43,000 Protestant missionaries around the world, two-thirds of them from America. Now, this has diminished quite a bit for a variety of reasons, but it's sort of the history upon which we build. And here's the other part that I think is fascinating. This is one of the things I love about going to work in Africa. Of course, the colonial era ended post-World War II, and this just gives you the timeline of the independence of the African nations, which I would encourage you to read about if you're not familiar with it. But what happened is everybody said, gee, you know, all these missionaries are out there. It's under the colonial rule, and therefore it's easier for them to be there. I wonder what will happen to the church once these missionaries start pulling back, which many of them did, of course. And what happened is that the church in Africa has just absolutely taken off. And it's really exciting. One of the things that Amy and I love about going to Africa, we never go at the same time, by the way, because we have four kids. So Amy will be off in Ethiopia or the Congo, and I'll be off in Malawi a different month. And sometimes the kids go with if they can, or at least the littlest one is gone. But one of the joys of being in Africa is you want to talk about an on-fire, growing, vibrant faith community. It's wonderful. But there's huge, huge needs. This is one of the things that draws me to Africa. It's estimated by 2025 that most of the Christians in the world will clearly be in the Southern Hemisphere. They'll be in Africa and Latin America. And so the world is changing substantially from a Christian point of view, and it's really going to be exciting to be a part of that. So Africa seems to be the place on the globe where the work of the Holy Spirit is exploding. And yet, here's the part where I think I feel like I come in as a physician, and in particular, a public health-oriented physician. Most of that part of the world is in extreme poverty. 1.2 billion people were living in poverty, surviving on less than a dollar a day in 2003. Definitely not flourishing. More than 800 million people are malnourished, and malnutrition causes more than half of all child deaths worldwide. And most of the severe poverty in the world is concentrated in Africa. These are the countries that have over 75% of their people living on less than a dollar a day. So there's a great deal of poverty in Africa. Yet there's extreme gluttony in the U.S. and in the West in general. In 1997, the poorest one-fifth only made 1/74th of what the richest 1/5 did in the Western nations. 66% of U.S. adults are overweight or obese, and we've gained on average 20 pounds in the last 20 years. In the U.S., we spend $237 billion on advertising, and worldwide that's $463 billion. And the goal of advertising, this always fascinates me, my kids are now attuned to this, when they listen to commercials they laugh, but the whole goal is to make you discontent, to create desire for things you probably really don't need. And that creates what I call the middle, or not myself, of course others have, the middle class poor, those who feel like they're poor because they don't quite have the things that others have. Now that I know you didn't write this, I won't be poking, but I was looking at challenges and strengths, which I assume is to some career choices, and one of them was lack of funds. I think that was probably for academic life, and I thought to myself, you know, one of the beauties of working in Africa is you come home and you appreciate everything, and you realize you do not lack funds. It's one of the joys of taking our young child, our 9-year-old, now 12-year-old with us. He has a whole different perspective on world and poverty. But people would say we're very generous in the U.S., and the per capita GNP in the U.S. is about $45,000. In 2003, the U.S. government spent 0.14% on foreign aid compared to 2.79% post-World War II. So we're giving far less as a percentage of our gross domestic product internationally than we ever were in the past. But when you survey Americans and ask, about how much do you think your government gives in foreign aid, they typically overestimate by 20 to 50 times. So we have a perception of ourselves as being very generous. Actually, as a percentage of our GNP, we're very far down the list. Countries like Ireland and the Scandinavian countries are much higher than us as far as percentage. So every year, Americans spend $30 to $50 billion on diets, $40 billion on alternative medicine. And so this amount alone, if distributed differently worldwide, would vaccinate all the children in the world, assure no malnutrition, and supply safe water, and there would even be leftover to institute basic primary care. So there's a lot of resources out there. So I want to go back to health, because this is all building up to why I do what I do and what I hope to infuse in others in the future. So health is either the absence of disease, which is kind of the common view. The dictionary will tell you that health is your physical state. WHO, any of you who have done public health know the Alma Ata, you know, the definition of health from that conference is the state of total physical, mental, and spiritual well-being, which of course means none of us are healthy because none of us are in that view. And then there's the Christian view. And I share this with my residents, actually, fairly openly, and I think they'd like to hear what motivates us. I think our theology of medicine is based on Genesis 1:26. We are all made in the image of God, male and female, made in God's image. So right away we start with this view. When Amy was talking about the prostitute who comes in, I took care, of course, with HIV patients, sort of a stigmatized group. And one of the events that happened to me early in my career at Lawndale is a young woman, a Caucasian woman, came in who was part of a multi-drug-resistant TB outbreak, and she had HIV. Actually, we were checking her for HIV. She was part of this big outbreak, and she looked really familiar, and her name was vaguely familiar. Anyway, partway through the conversation, I realized we went to grammar school together. I grew up on the west side of Chicago, and we had gone different ways. She was rehabbing herself. She was taking methadone, getting off drugs, and fortunately she was HIV negative when we did the test. But it was really kind of an aha moment for me, because I remember this little girl who I went to grammar school with, and I realized, you know, this person's basically like me. God loves her, God loves me. This is really an interesting position to be in, to start looking at your patients as people equal in God's eyes. We're all made in the image of God. But of course there's the fall, and we are in a different position now. And yet, after the fall, there's the cross. So, Christian view, medicine is a model of the healing in the context of the cross. So I'm going to tell you something really scary, which occurred to me when I was in divinity school. As a physician, you're actually a model of Christ. Whether you believe it or not, whether you have that theology or not, you are actually one of the most concrete examples that many people will see of the healing of brokenness. And so you're giving them just an imperfect glimpse of what Christ's whole ministry is about, which is bringing us to wholeness, of course, in a more complete way than we often think of in medicine, where we're focused only on the physical. But you are really a model of Christ's healing presence. So medicine is the exercise in the repudiation of death, on the one hand, and the anticipation of redemption and resurrection of the body. Therefore, even if people are unaware, the health provider is reminding us that we are under the curse, and yet there's the cross, there's hope. So what better profession to be in than medicine, I think, to be an easy Christian witness to people. So now shifting to health. There are 11 million children die each year before they reach the age of 5, in most cases by easily treatable or preventable diseases. So I didn't want to raise my hand and speak against someone of such stature as Francis Collins, but I want to say, wait a minute, we've got a lot of the tools we need right now. You know, it's great that you move ahead with genes, but you know, we have a lot of things we can do for millions and millions of people, and they're quite simple. So right now, 11 million children a year die of treatable, preventable diseases without fancy medicine. That's 30,000 a day, or the equivalent of 10 World Trade Center disasters. So can you imagine, like, if the World Trade Center blew up every day 10 times over and it had children in it, we would be a little upset. And yet we don't take any real notice day to day of this tragedy that occurs throughout the world. So what are those illnesses? They're basically AIDS, malaria, tuberculosis, diarrhea, measles. ARI is pneumonia. I worked for 5 years on a pneumonia project in Malawi. And then there's maternal perinatal conditions, which are often inadequate OB care for women. So I'm going to go to a few highlights. HIV, one of the reasons I like working in sub-Saharan Africa, in addition to the excitement of the church there and the ability for me to even more bring my faith and medicine closely, I think one of the disadvantages of being in the academy compared to Amy is the faith is not obviously a part of what I do day to day. When I'm asked to consult on a patient as an infectious disease physician, they're not necessarily expecting me to start out by asking them about their faith, although we often get there throughout the day. But so sub-Saharan Africa also happens to have the burden, the world burden of HIV by and large, as well as tuberculosis, the two diseases that I know the most about and I do the most research on. So it's an area where I'm intellectually stimulated from a medical point of view, spiritually stimulated and allowed to participate as a person with a master's in divinity. I'm able to teach and help nurture the church as well as teach their physicians how to provide care for HIV patients. HIV, of course, has been devastating. You can see the dotted lines are life expectancy. Africa's developing throughout the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s. Life expectancies are starting to approach those of the West, and then the HIV epidemic hits and they plummet. And so life expectancies in places like Malawi are now at 37, 38 years compared to where they were around 60 years before. There are 15 million AIDS orphans worldwide. So not only are the parents dying, but children are left without parents. I want to bring this up because if you ever get a chance to find this book, it's called The Awake Project. It's a really interesting project on basically the evangelical answer to HIV. And the Barna, who I'm sure many of you are familiar with, did a survey in 2002 and found that evangelical Christians were the least likely group to help AIDS victims in Africa. Less than 7% said they would help a Christian organization minister to AIDS orphans, and over 50% said they definitely would not help, even with education efforts to prevent AIDS. So there's still a bit of a barrier here, to say the least. And I think, fortunately, you all here, the younger generation, I think are less involved in this stigma than sort of some of us old-timers have to deal with. I like to quote, I have so many med students and residents who want to go work overseas, which is one of the reasons we're cultivating these international rotations. And I jokingly refer to it as the Bono effect. You know, Bono really brought it to the forefront. But Pope John Paul II, Jimmy Carter, and Bono have all said that history will judge us on how we deal with this AIDS in Africa crisis. And I think that's true. And so I think as you as Christian healthcare providers, keep that tucked in your brain. What can you do? At the very least, what you can do, I think, is you can vote for people who are likely to give funding to address these issues. And you can make it known to your legislators that it's important to you that we continue things like the PEPFAR funding. And then I'm just going to mention a few things about Malawi. These are pictures of the clinic, one here that Amy took of a child with kwashiorkor with the orange hair, the UNICEF overflow tent for the countless pediatric patients, literally 80 patients in a 14-bed ward overflowing. This is the countryside in Malawi, women carrying child. And I just want to end with a success story from Malawi, which is something that Christians can do, which is really interesting. They decided that in Malawi, they don't want to create big orphanages for all these kids. Of the 13 million Malawians, 1 million of them are orphans. And to create orphanages would disrupt family, a lot of problems. So the communities have come together. They donate land. Charitable organizations like Medical Benevolence Foundation and others have designed and will come build like a pavilion. And UNICEF will supply food so the kids can have one good meal a day. And then the families absorb the orphans. But now instead of three kids, they've got seven. Well, they can't feed seven. They can't take care of seven. So these orphan, these community-based orphan care centers take all the kids, whether you're an orphan or not, sibling of an orphan. You go there for the day. You get an education. You get a good meal. And in some cases, even some health care is provided. And it allows the families to continue to raise the children. And these are projects that many of the churches are involved with there. And then there's also orphan care homes where you can take kids in who are too young to be cared for by family members because they're still of a nursing age and perhaps the mom has died. And then once these kids get older, they can be reintegrated into the family, the extended family. So I'm going to end with 1 Timothy. And it's a bit of a tough verse to think about. Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasures for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life. So I guess what I thematically have found my career, it went from thinking I was going to be a Bush Hospital missionary doctor to being an inner city doctor taking care of TB and AIDS patients to being an academic doctor who teaches students and residents how to take care of patients with AIDS and other infections and to cultivate, hopefully, in them a vision of using their lives in these ways, which is why we try to take the students and residents overseas, encourage them to go overseas and get an experience, and hopefully that'll become a part of them. And so I guess with that I'll end and see if there's...
Tell them who you took on your last trip. Oh,
well, one of the things that I do is I don't restrict my trips. Even though I'm working with a Christian hospital in Malawi, I don't restrict who comes with. It's open. And so one of my residents who came with me is a Muslim woman, and one of the students was the president of our Christian Medical and Dental Society. And we actually met up a couple of Australian students there. So it actually turned out to be a wonderful way to witness, because we live in the same house. We cook our meals together. We live our life together for a month. And so it's a very, it's beyond the usual academic mentoring. They get to taste my cooking. If they don't like it, they're out of luck. It was cute because Miriam would, there's enormous spiders in Malawi that are fairly intense looking. And I'd hear the shriek and I'm like, okay, I'll come and kill the spiders. And that was my main job, was to kill the spiders. But Miriam came to church with us. She came to Bible study with us. She really had her eyes opened, I think, to what a vibrant, real Christian faith was. Because I think often non-Christians in this country, whether they're unchurched or they're of another faith, they have a caricature of what Christians are. They don't really see what I think are really Christ-centered people who are serving others, who love Jesus, love their neighbor. And Miriam was welcomed into the community and continues to actually be a resident now, a fellow who I mentor along, although I certainly can't say that she's become a Christian yet, but I certainly pray for her. So it's really, to me, it's a wonderful opportunity to not only reach out to my patients, I now sort of mentor and reach out to students and residents, and we serve the folks in Africa, hopefully helping them as we go there to teach and train. So I'll open it up for any questions. You know, I'm pretty open. I'm in a good situation, and I tell people that to me is one of the things that you can't take lightly, is working in an environment that is good. I'm director of the MedPeds residency program, and I'm the director of pediatric infectious diseases. My chairman of pediatrics is a really solid guy, committed Christian, very supportive of my work. The chairman of medicine is a very committed Jewish guy who's also very supportive of my work because, you know, the Jewish heritage of service and a good friend and colleague. So I have not found it. I know maybe some people, but I'm pretty open and I'm pretty, I think, accepted. I think one of the things you have to do, though, as a Christian, is you have to be, I think, gracious, not sort of hostile to others, which you can be if you're not careful. And I think you have to be excellent, because there are people, I think, who will look for opportunity to be dismissive. And so if you're excellent in all that you do and you're consistent, I think you're not going to have too much trouble. At least I have not had much trouble. Now, that's a small world. I have not experienced other academic places. When I was at CDC, we had a Bible study for CDC workers that was my direct supervisor. He was an antagonistic atheist, but we had lunch together most days of the week, and he would make his comments, and I would just smile. And, you know, it really didn't bother either of us. I think he was probably a little uncomfortable, but we had most of our division in parasitology actually attended the Bible study by the time I left. But it hasn't been, I haven't found it hard. I don't know, probably have you found the academic world?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes and no.
Definitely. I was told on our orientation to third year in medical school that the hospital is not the place to save people. And I thought that was kind of interesting.
So you should have raised your hand. You know, one of the things I do probably more than most is I use a lot of humor. So I would probably have said, "So we're here to kill them." But I can see some people. But I think you just politely stand firm, and you'll be surprised how many other Christians are around. I think once you start to be, you know, sort of openly, but conversational, but not confrontational. I also find in my personal experience, in pediatrics, which is where I spend probably 80% of my energy, only about 20% of my time is in adult medicine now, mostly for mothers of my children with HIV. But pediatrics are easygoing. Pediatricians are just basically nice people. Even if they disagree with you, they're not going to be that hostile. It's just in their blood to be nice. Yes.
Yeah,
maybe
just a comment. I'm a Kenyan, and so from one of those regions over there. But more importantly, I spent 5 years in Botswana, where mm-hmm. it's like the highest HIV.
Yes.
So I was able to see for the very first time HIV very up close, and you know, it's not just theoretical pictures there, it's faces, it's people. And right now I'm in a postdoc fellowship at the Center for HIV AIDS Research, and I'm looking at prescription drugs and that, the role of that. But I'm just wondering about how you were to do that, because the main handicap, even that you're saying you wanted to raise your hand and say, look, you're going to have to go to genome therapy, you know, we need drug therapy in Africa, you know. How do you deal with the whole scars of, you know, that whole justice of, you know, prescription drugs, you know, the need for access for those drugs, even food for them?
I mean, the truth is you need everything. Like, I'm more of a public health person. Last time I was in the laboratory doing research was during fellowship when I had to. So, but I respect the laboratory people. We never have a polio vaccine without the Enders of the world. And so that is important. So each of us has our niche. And so some people have the niche of advocacy. You know, like Paul Farmer is an advocate for just distribution of HIV drugs. I think one of the jobs you can have in academics, which is really helpful, is to be that voice. Because at least in our university, and I'm sure it's in most, in medicine, the glamour is to the glitz, you know, the transplants, the latest, greatest, you know, newest thing. Like in our pediatric department, we're developing a very intense catheter ablation, pediatric congenital heart thing. People get excited about that because we are pushing the envelope technologically. But I think you just be a constant voice of, you know, don't forget, you know, these are the important things. So I think that's what you have to do, is just sort of persistently, quietly. We have founded and formed a medical student group of those interested in international health and global health. And so we meet periodically, about monthly, and we have a different speaker, and we talk about global health issues. So you can always be that voice in the academy that helps people see that side of it. I think that's the best you can do, really. But I, as much as I was sort of quibbing about we don't need to genetics, it's not true, of course. We need the people like that to push the envelope of science to help us understand things, because perhaps we can get to a better stage scientifically. But I would encourage you, I think we're at a really exciting time from a public health point of view, largely because of Gates and Buffett and the real serious interest in international public health and issues of justice. And I do think it had a lot to do with the public persona of people like Bono and John Paul II and others who have really pushed that to the forefront. So it's an exciting time to be interested in international health and public health. Yes.
First of all, thank you both of you for coming, and been a long time admirer of everything that happens at Volunteer. One thing I'm sure you're asked a lot, and this is what medical students think about is approaching residencies. It's amazing that you have a two-physician household with four kids. And how are you able to maintain any resemblance?
you know how we've done this is I'm not a full-time physician. I'm a part-time physician. And we've used almost every combination.
combination of childcare and hospital. We would use relatives. One day I had this babysitter who left a note on the counter that said she quit. And I was working late the next day, and I just called the local university and got their babysitting list and called until I found someone. I mean, yes, we've had challenges. We've used, you know, all sorts of things. But I have also wanted to raise my own kids. I really did. We have plenty of friends. They have live-in au pairs. They've done all sorts of things. But I just wanted to be there. I wanted to be their Girl Scout leader. I wanted to do art in class with them. And I've been very privileged to do that because there are not very many places I think that you could work. And Lawndale has always said to me, we'll take you whenever I'll work. So.
We tried one year. The first year at Lawndale, we actually tried a job share situation where we would be one full-time equivalent between the two of us, and that was a disaster. And so what I found is I wanted to work more, and Amy wanted to work less. And so I think what you have to do is you have to figure out what sort of gives you joy. I could not be a full-time. I wasn't really even very good as a part-time mom. So I said, you know, honey, I'd rather work and pay somebody to be with the kids because I love to play with them when I come home, but I cannot entertain them all day.
They took them out to the museum
every
day.
Oh my gosh. Every day I had them, I'd be off at the museum with them because I couldn't think of anything else to do, so I would just go to all of them. So, and the kids probably were grateful when we gave up on that idea. But it is hard. You know, it is hard, and I think, you know, I sometimes joke to our parents' generation that, boy, they had it so much easier because the rules were so set. You know, but nowadays you've got situations where two very capable people want to have a family and be professionals, and how do you do it? The good news is I think medicine is more amenable to that than many other fields. I'm not so sure you're going to be, you know, chair of the Department of Medicine as a part-time physician. You know, it's hard to overcome that because there's still some bias, but at least in one area that I find this is true is in pediatrics, where now 80% of pediatricians are women. There's an awful lot of sympathy for the raising the family track, and so there's a lot of give and take there that wasn't present 20 years ago. And the kids become self-sufficient, and I think it's telling that none of our kids have said anything positive about going into medicine. That they tell you a lot about their view of the work and how hard it is. So. Yes.
You mean that funded church, is funded church to take out the orphan
So what I love about working in Africa is they are not crazed with separation of church and state. They think that, in fact, I think if you had that conversation, they would think you were nuts, absolutely nuts. Because spirituality is such an important part for most people. It's woven in throughout their lives. And flat out, 40 to 60% of the healthcare is provided by missionary hospitals throughout sub-Saharan Africa. And so the district hospital that I take students to is a mission hospital that has government physicians and nurses and missionaries, and it gets mission support and it gets government support, but it functions as a local district hospital, which would be like the local county hospital. So the idea of working together is not a foreign concept in Africa, which is also, I think, it's more fun to work there. There's not really that sense of separation.
How about those countries where churches are not represented?
Well, I think obviously there'd be a big difference there. I can say that Lawndale has an outreach ministry now in Afghanistan, where doctors from Lawndale are going there, as well as other providers, nurses and other providers. And that's a much different situation. It's a mission hospital that provides care, but it's very quiet with its Christian witness because of the laws and rules of that country. And it's by no means supported by the government. So I think the model would have to depend entirely on where you're at in the world, you know, what the relationship is. For me personally, we had this conversation at Lawndale a lot with the leadership there. They feel called to an unreached people group, which is why they're going to Afghanistan. I feel called to ministering and developing my Christian brothers and sisters. And so I feel like my gifts are not so much as evangelism as much as they are discipleship. So I'd love to go to Africa and teach how to use the HIV drugs, how to take care of patients, how to be a better Christian, to preach, and sort of nurtured by fellow believers along, as opposed to going to a place where there are other Christians. But I think the nice thing about medicine is you could do either of those things if that's your calling. I have a roommate of mine from med school days is director of transplant at Pittsburgh Children's. And he goes to Muslim countries on trips to train their physicians, but he sees that as part of his Christian witness, is to go to places where he can go as a transplant surgeon, but could not go as an evangelist. But he was going, in his mind, as an evangelist. So there are ways you can use your, and he's, of course, getting there by virtue of being a high-powered academic, you know, transplant surgeon. So you can use it in a variety of ways, but I think that in the case of closed countries, it would have to be done differently, probably more as a tent maker in a quiet way.
Question. Are you able to work with
the
local universities? I'm sure
there's a medical school. Yes, we are. In fact, we unsuccessfully put in for a Doris Duke Foundation grant to develop the primary care model in Malawi with the university. And so I do work with them, and I do like visiting professor rounds at the major teaching hospital to try. Because I think that's one of my gifts is to teach and to understand perhaps at a deeper level than some of their providers that have, many of them haven't had the opportunities I've had to go to various schools. So I like to go and teach, and so I work with them. It's really, to me, it's fun. And one of the things the Gates Foundation wants to do, which is what I'd like to do with Rush, is they call it twinning, which is basically just sistering universities here with developing country training centers, whether it's a university or a college or nursing, so that we can transfer information and technology more quickly. It's one thing to have the drugs, it's another thing to sort of dump $300 million worth of AIDS meds in Malawi, but now you've got to train all these people how to use them. And the best way, I think, to do it is to have sort of this twinning where we have faculty from here going and teaching around.
I just had a quick question. You shared about going to Africa, and I'm wondering if you think there's a role for non-primary care specialties in regions like Africa.
There are. I think that clearly the most important at one level is clearly primary care. In fact, to be honest, the most important thing is clean water immunization. So it's even more basic than I typically do. But in Malawi, Malawi is one of the more underdeveloped in some ways. It's a very poor country, and its healthcare system is very underdeveloped. They've only had a medical school for about 10 years. They are looking into this possibility of having various district hospitals be training centers. So they're going to designate one in Luanda, the capital, as the training center for subspecialties. And so there would be a great opportunity for an ear, nose, and throat, an OB-GYN, a cardiologist. But your goal is really to train, because you're not that valuable if someone goes and takes care of patients for 30 days. Your real training is to go and show them how to use the echo machine to look at the heart, or to show them how to do this complex surgical procedure. So in Malawi, that is possible. Now, in other sites, it's much more developed. Botswana has a sister relationship with Penn. Uganda has a sister relationship with McCrary, with Yale. They're with Yale. And so those are places where you can get subspecialists to go and train. So I think there are those opportunities.
There are also places like the Democratic Republic of Congo, where, you know, women are raped, where fistula formation, there's just, they need people who know how to do those corrective procedures. There's one person in the whole country, and there's thousands and thousands of women. And that was true in Malawi, too, because of obstructed labor. And there was only one OBGYN who's leading now who knew how to do that.
And so what they've done is this OBGYN or someone from here can go and spend several months training, and they literally train what are called clinical officers to do these procedures, which are really high school grads with 2 years of clinical training. But it works, and so that kind of training is quite available.
I was just going to ask where you folks lived and how you chose that route when you came back from the CDC.
That's a lot.
You know, we kind of knew Miriam was going to need special education. And the way the law works here in Illinois is that you receive your services in the district in which you live. And the patients in Lawndale can't get special education services. So we were the very first physicians who did not make a commitment to live in the neighborhood, which was a little bit of a trouble at first. And we weren't sure. I mean, we were very hopeful that you know, hearing seizures would resolve, that maybe we would be out. In fact, we told Art, we'll give you 3 years. and to start the AIDS clinic, the TB and all that. Well, about by that point, we were in school, and now she's, you know, needing orthopedic care and, you know, spine surgery and eye surgery, and things just persisted. So we kept realizing, gosh, you know, but the school issue, there was not a school. There was no school that was started. Most of the folks who had children who could get their kids into a magnet school by taking a test, Marion could never do that. She's 20 years old now, and she really cannot make change for a dollar. So she would have to go to a local school. So we never made that commitment. And at one point, we lived in Oak Park, which is just a few minutes away from the west side of Chicago. And she was being bussed up to Northbrook, which is more than an hour, because that was the best, that was the school that they could handle her in. And then eventually, we moved up closer to Northbrook. So she would be commuting several hours a day. We would be commuting. So that's
so
what
we
made three moves based on her schooling.
Yeah. So we live right now in Evanston, which is the first suburb north, which for us works because of the school system for Miriam. And also, personally, I like it. I grew up in Chicago, New York City, and I'm more urban. And Evanston's a bit more urban. It's about 40% Caucasian, 40% African-American, 15% Hispanic. And it's got a broader socioeconomic spectrum than does many of the other suburbs. And that's been an important place for us to live as opposed to a more classically suburban, although it's clearly got good schools and a good suburban system. And that's always the limiting factor. In fact, frankly, that's the thing that keeps us from being overseas. We anticipate once we clear the house of kids going over and finishing our career in Africa or possibly someplace else, but most likely Africa.
That's one of the hardest things for people overseas, too, is their children, because at some point kids end up having to leave the country or board somewhere. And when I was covering for this one doctor in Malawi for about a month, she had two girls that I took care of them too, because I said, well, that's easy. I'm a mom. I know how to do that too. Actually, I was counting on the hospital work being a lot more difficult, which it was, than taking care of her kids. But her oldest daughter was in the last grade that was available. She would have to go to Kenya. There was nothing in Malawi for her daughter. And they were debating, did she leave the field? And does she feel good enough about her child boarding, you know? At 12 years of age, being away most of the year and only coming back for vacation. So many missionary families face that education issue.
Our youngest, who's a sixth grader, is very open to the idea. He's game to go to Africa anytime. He's been there, he loves it, he thinks it's great. And we joke that that'll really get people's attention on your application to college, you know. Mm-hmm. Just another kid from Illinois as opposed to a kid from rural Malawi, that'll rise to the top. So anyway, kids have really dictated a lot of what we have had to do with our time.
I've heard from some sending agencies, different mission agencies, that they think mission hospitals are on the out, and community health will be more the dominant medical mission model. What do you think about that? Is there still a place for a mission hospital?
That's good.
Staffed by Western physicians?
I probably didn't make it clear, but we're sort of more both community health oriented than the classic hospital, although my specialty is a hospital-based specialty in many areas of the world. I think that's true. But I think you probably always need some level. The question is whether mission agencies want to put their resources in the hospital. I do think that's probably the wrong way. I personally think community-based care is a better way to go, more primary care. I personally, for my own work, I see myself training, so I probably, for instance, the hospital we go to in Tacoma has 13 village health centers that are tied to it. So part of our job when we're there is to go out to those community health centers and train and see patients, but basically a mentoring type role. So I'm not sure it's as much of an either or as the books lead you to believe. Once you get overseas, you realize the two systems are pretty woven together. But I personally think that's a better use of resources rather than going, we joke about this because Amy's on the Medical Benevolence Foundation board, so she reviews applications for funds. It's the funding out of the Presbyterian Church and for medical missions. And there are people who want to do things like CT scans and rural, or cardiac cath labs, and that's probably not the smartest use of resources, in my opinion. I think the better use is to have a more tiered system, and the most important layer is the one right near the patients. So I think that
you will always need tertiary care. Without your surgeon, you'll die with your appendix. And so there's some level at which we have to recognize that we need those things. And there are many places that don't have tertiary care. It's very expensive to have a hospital. and with limited resources, even a medical school, I mean, they chose in Malawi for a long time not to train doctors.
Right.
Very deliberately.
They trained clinical officers because they felt like if they trained doctors, they would just
leave. They would
lose
them. Yeah.
And what they really needed was frontline clinical officers. So they've trained nurses and clinical officers who can't, they're not certified in any way that will function in the West, so they won't be drained away. So it was a thoughtful thing on their part to do that. What I tell people, I taught for several years, part-time, of course, because I've done all these other things, at Wheaton for some of their kids who were going into medicine in one of their biology classes. And what I would tell people is you've got to figure out what you want to do. If you get great joy from unraveling the human genome, then do it to God's glory. But if you get great joy from being a surgeon, sure, do that. It's not, you will have a role, it's just a different role. But I think if somebody, what I told the students there, if you really want to just get to the front lines, and you want to make an impact and you're wide open, then I would encourage studying public health and perhaps doing something like PA, nurse practitioner, that's a little bit of a shorter training process, and really learn, that teaches you 90% of what you're going to need at the front lines. And you don't have to go through the medical school route if that's where your joy is. But if the path of phys and all that is your joy, then go for it. Go to medical school. I mean, you guys are all in, so it's too late to bail out.
So do we have time for maybe one more question?
It's late.
Okay, it's fine. All right. Jim Navy, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.